All right, so I'm going to give a flying overview here of software-defined storage with ZFS and the deployment best practices under which you can best deploy. Primarily, my presentation covers production commercial environments, but I will touch on some home user use and stuff like that just for those of you that like to use ZFS for home use and stuff like that. It's a very robust file system. We'll get into some of the caveats of its use, some of the things you need to be aware of before you get started with it, as far as adoption goes and stuff like that. And then I'll also talk about disk architectures, pool structures, and stuff like that for varying types of workloads. So as we get through this, the first thing we need to talk about is what is software-defined storage. And software-defined storage is an approach to data storage in which the programming that controls the storage-related tasks is decoupled from the physical storage hardware. A lot of legacy systems have firmware types of controls within the hardware itself that define how the software is, or defines how the storage is used. In software-defined storage, everything is in the software itself, and that actually keeps it remote from the hardware, and that gives you a lot of different freedoms. Some of the benefits of using software-defined storage is the freedom to choose the gear you run on, right? So if you don't want to pay top dollar for really top flight gear from the top flight providers like EMC or a network appliance or something like that, you want to use commodity gear and a software-defined storage solution, put the two together, and you can get a really, really fine storage system that way. One of the other freedoms that you get is the fact that as hardware advances, you can just replace your hardware with new hardware. So you can use the latest and greatest stuff all the time and just migrate your software and your pools as you transfer forward. Right? So that gives us a lot of really cool advantages. It also protects us from vendor lock-in, right? And for those of you that are may not be familiar with that term, that's when you have to pay $2,000 for a disk that you can go to Fry's and pay $200 for. Okay? So we're protected from that. We don't have to worry about the caveats. There are several builds out there available now. With me today is Steve Umbihocker. He is from OS Nexus, and he has a product called QuantaStore. And he'll talk about how QuantaStore leverages the software-defined storage concept in his product a little bit later on. So that's his product. Then, of course, there's several others out there that are using ZFS. And these are just a few. There's more of them probably than I can name. If we all got together and researched on the internet, we could probably come up with 200 of them. But these are the ones that are most known. The interesting thing about some of these is that one of these kids is not like the other. OS Nexus, for example, is ZFS on Linux, where the other three up here are all using either an Illumos or a Solaris kernel. So the next thing we want to talk about is what is ZFS? And ZFS is a file system that was developed by Sun Microsystems that was announced in September of 2004. So quite some time ago. I put the RIP up there, poor guys. They did this as a way to actually leverage high-performance computing before they realized what they had as far as a storage file system is concerned. It is one of the most powerful, flexible, and robust file systems available today. On top of that, ZFS is open source and free. So ZFS is much more than just a file system. It has many elements of what is traditionally referred to as a volume manager, and I'll show you that in a diagram in a little bit. So it does have a lot of different caveats to it. Like I said before, there's going to be some things that I get into today that may not jive with regular understandings of storage as far as legacy perspectives is concerned. So if you have any questions or anything like that, if I happen to mention something that defies conventional wisdom, it's only just because that's the way it's done with ZFS. And you'll see what I mean as we go forward. So let's talk about a couple of things about why ZFS is awesome, right? And the first one is it's a 128-bit file system, okay? Everybody's heard the term boil the oceans before, and the reference there is that there actually is not enough electricity created by the Earth to power as much storage as you could put in one ZFS file system today, okay? So that's, I know it sounds pretty out there, but the limitation of ZFS as far as a file system is concerned is 250 quadrillion zettabytes. And to put that into perspective, one zettabyte is a billion terabytes. So, you know, if you could put that many disks in one place and hook them all up, you'd figure out how to make one big, enormous pool. The really cool thing about it, too, is that could all be a contiguous namespace. So you don't have to carve it all up just to make it addressable. Okay. One of the other things is copy on write. Has anybody ever worked with a copy on write file system before? ButterFS, Btree, which one? Okay, cool. So copy on write is actually a very unique function. It ensures the data is always consistent on the disk. By using copy on write, what that means is that when the data is changed, it's not overwritten. It's written to a new section of disk. And then the pointers that point to that data aren't changed until everything has been committed. And that allows it to maintain the data integrity, also through a 256-bit checksum. So that's where the end-to-end data protection comes from, where the checksums are stored in metadata that's separate from the actual data itself, okay? And that, when commits are happening, unlike, excuse me, this basically protects us against things like phantom writes, misdirected reads and writes, and silent data corruption. If you're familiar with the term called data rot or bit rot, some of us from the old-fashioned days that used to use floppy disks, you know, you fish a floppy disk out of your little disk box and go, I remember this, and then you go to, you stick it in your floppy drive and you go to, you know, look at that picture that you didn't remember from 15 years ago and only half of it shows up. The same thing happens on hard disk. When you write to a data archive and it just sits there, it doesn't get accessed. Legacy systems don't know how to correct data that's just sitting there, okay? ZFS can do that by doing a scrub. And scrubs are normally set up to be done about once a week or so. And what happens then is that the data is actually checked against that checksum from the metadata to ensure that it's in the same condition it was in when it was originally written. And if it's not, it's corrected. So no matter how long, no matter how long it's been there, no matter how many times it's been overlooked, or no matter how many times it's been accessed or not accessed, that data is checked on that scrub to make sure that the data remains intact. So the other thing that we're going to talk about is integrated volume manager and RAID stack. And we'll talk about some of the RAID levels and how volumes are designed, created, and shared. But the interesting thing about ZFS is that it encompasses the entire I/O stack. So it's not just a file system sitting on top of an abstraction layer, which is sitting on top of hardware. It's the entire stack. And then we have built-in features like compression, snapshots, hybrid storage, the ability to leverage solid-state devices mixed in with spinning disk in order to gain very high performance. If anybody ever saw the Sun comparison, where they took 24, 15,000 RPM disks and put them in a RAID array in RAID 10, and then five 7,200 RPM cheap SATA disks that they bought at Fry's with an SSD on the front and an SSD on the back, and got nearly triple the performance of the array from the 15K SAS disks. Right? They were able to do that by leveraging read and write caching that exists within ZFS by assigning a ZIL accelerator and then also having an L2 ARC device. And I'll get into exactly how those fit into the architecture a little bit later on. So some of the definitions that we're going to talk about today and some of the terms I'm going to use as we talk about building architectures. First of all is a Zpool, and a Zpool is constructed of what we refer to as VDEVs, virtual devices. And a VDEV can be a disk, can be a mirrored pair of disks, a RAID set of disks, any number of disks built into a VDEV, and then the VDEVs are then added into a pool. And every VDEV that you put into a pool gets striped. Okay, so you're basically going to get the RAID 0 effect at the pool level, and all of your redundancy and fault tolerance comes out of the construction of your VDEVs, okay? The next thing we're going to talk about is ARC, and that's the adaptive replacement cache. And the ARC remains in system memory. So when you build out a ZFS-based system, you're going to want to use as much memory as your budget will allow. That's basically kind of the rule of thumb, okay? 7/8 of your physical memory is going to be dedicated for ARC, okay? So ARC is derived by an algorithm that is based on the last written data and the most often read data. And it has a promote and evict policy that allows blocks to get migrated into ARC and out of ARC kind of on an as-needed basis. So it's dynamic, it does it for you. There's no turning it on or turning it off. You're going to get it no matter what. So you might as well use it, right? Also, out of that other 1/8 that's available, that's assigned for system resources, metadata overhead, and stuff like that. So 7/8 of your physical memory goes to ARC. And then you can extend that arc space by adding a solid state device, and that's where you get an L2 arc, which would be the level 2. And it'll migrate and evict out of arc and into L2 arc kind of as you grow out. So one of the best practices that we like to do in a production environment is assess what the working set size is of your data, right? Most people that come to me that say they need 100 terabytes, they don't have 100 terabytes of hot data. They have maybe 5, okay? So we'd put in about 5 terabytes of solid state to go along with the pool disks, and that means that all of their hot data, everything that's important and needs to be accessed right away, is all coming out of solid state or system memory. Question?
Is the solid state caching the same pool as the RAM, or can you layer that? Because solid state's obviously not going to be as fast as RAM.
Yeah. The L2 arc is actually built into the disk pool structure. Okay? So if you have multiple pools, you could have some that you don't care about accelerating and some that you do. Now, arc is system-wide, okay? L2 arc is per pool. So when you build an L2 arc and you add it into your disk pool, and I'll show you when we get to there's a drawing of the overall structure where we have a bunch of disks, and then we have a bunch of VDEVs, and then we have a pool, right? In between there is where L2 arc resides, okay? And I'll give you an example. I've got customers where they have 15 terabytes of hot data and 200 terabytes of archive, all basically within the same deployment, okay? And so the hot data, obviously, we accelerate that. The archival data, we don't. So we assign L2 arc devices to that pool. And it's the same thing for ZIL. If you're going to accelerate ZIL, same thing, it's per pool. Okay, VDEV, we talked about that momentarily. And then the ZFS intent log. ZIL is where all the write transactions are coalesced. And so all the write requests come into the system, whether they're concurrent writes or synchronous writes or whatever, they all come into the system and they hit the ZIL. And the ZIL is where all those write transactions are coalesced, and then everything is then written to disk sequentially. So one of the key advantages to using ZFS in a storage system is that no matter what disks you're using, whether they be 7200 RPM or 15,000 RPM, they only have to be able to do sequential performance. The only thing you care about is whether they can write sequentially or not, because the ZIL and the L2 arc is going to protect those disks from having to do any highly random activity. Okay? Question?
So if you had a pool where you were doing a lot of concurrent writes, would that be where you would do the second level ZIL over the solid state drive?
Absolutely. Okay. That's exactly right. Now the one thing that you have to keep in mind when you are accelerating ZIL is that for home use, you can pretty much use whatever you want, right? But for a production environment, understand that 85 to 95% of everything you write is going to go through that device, okay? So the ZIL acceleration device has to be very, very write and very, very write resilient, okay? Because with all of that traffic going through it, if you take a run-of-the-mill consumer solid state drive and say it's 100 gigs, right, and its wear use is say 2 full drive writes per day, you're going to throw terabytes through that every single day, right? I've had clients in the field try using, you know, like a OCZ Vertex or something that you put in your laptop for a ZIL device, and they wore through its entire use in about a week. Okay, so it is possible to do that. Okay, there are a couple of devices out there that are actually specifically designed for ZIL acceleration. A couple of them are PCI Express based. One of them is called DDR Drive, which is pretty cool. And another one out there is that's a actual DRAM device in a solid state disk form factor. Is from S-Tech. It's called a Zeus RAM, and it's actually got DRAM inside it, and then a SuperCap flash backup, all built in it. So you have the resiliency you need. You have the protection you need in case of power failure. The one thing about ZIL is that the data that's in that is still in flight. It's not committed yet. So if the lights go out, the data that's in it, poof, right? But the Zeus RAM has that battery-backed flash in it. So everything that's going into that, if there were a power outage, the SuperCap keeps that device on and flushes everything from DRAM over to flash real quick, and it can retain it up to 7 years. So it's a very good device, very good for that. And of course, Zvol, ZFS volume is just a raw block device. That's what we use to share over iSCSI and Fibre Channel. Okay? And when we get to my diagram, you'll see that a little bit better. But these are just some terms that I might just throw out over the course of the presentation that's good to understand. So going into SDS basics, what do we need to have to do an SDS deployment? The first one's pretty simple. We're going to need a computer, right? And we talked about building that out already. Simple x86 box for home use, perfectly fine. Obviously, for production use, you'd want to use something a little bit more resilient. You know, the good old-fashioned standard stuff, you know, redundant power supplies, mirrored OS disks, good amount of RAM. You know, I like the Xeons. The AMD processors work just fine, too. Although there are some onboard devices that don't quite work too well with some of the Solaris-based SDS software that we saw before. I know the Illumos kernel doesn't have a lot of drivers for like Marvell NICs and Broadcom NICs don't work that well and stuff like that. So just a couple of things to think about if you're going to go the AMD route. On the Intel boards, pretty much everything's going to work just fine. And then we're going to need some disks. Okay, again, for home use, you know, use whatever you want. You know, the ZFS file system is going to protect you from losing data. It will actually lock itself and prevent you from accessing it if it thinks it's going to lose data. Okay, and then there are some recovery mechanisms that you can throw in that'll get you out of that bind. Okay, for production use, we prefer to use SAS. For a number of reasons, we can deploy multi-node high availability clusters with, you know, dual filers going into a shared storage pool, and you can't really do that with single-ported, single-channel disks. So you have to have dual-ported, dual-channel disks, and SAS are the ones that you'll need for that. So the interesting thing is the 7200 RPM SAS disks don't really cost that much more than enterprise SATA anyway. So you might as well just use the good stuff, okay? Next thing we're gonna need is how to connect it all, okay? So interconnecting between the computer and the disks, we like to use, you know, external shelves. Then we like to connect to the computer over external SAS. So that's all 6 gig transport. We'll have 12 gig coming up pretty soon. Actually, Q4 this year is when LSI is gonna launch its 12 gig cards. We're not gonna have disks yet. There's always something that's holding us up, right? So, but we will have the cards though, so that's kind of cool. But the cool thing there, we're using the LSI 9200 series host bus adapters for that, and it works really well. Drivers for pretty much everybody is out there. You know, QantaStore supports them. Actually, QantaStore, we use a little bit different connection mechanism, and Steve will talk about how we actually use hardware RAID with ZFS RAID, and we're getting some really interesting results and some performance gains from that as well. So then we're gonna, you know, apply the chosen software-defined storage solution. So for the folks that like the free stuff out there, you know, the free NAS has ZFS, right? Just plain old BSD has ZFS. So there's lots of free options out there if you wanna, you know, if you wanna hack away. But the cool thing is, you know, building VDEVs is a single command. It doesn't take a lot of hackery if you're doing it solely from the command line. I can take a system from install to deployed storage just from the command line without any type of management interface or anything. About an hour, I can have it all shared out. So it's not that hard, and I'm not an engineer, I'm a salesman. So I want to talk a little bit about the different RAID levels that are available in ZFS from the software side. And the first one is two-way mirror. This is the recommended deployment method where you take mirrored disks and add them to the pool, take another pair of mirrored disks, add them to the pool, and so on and so on and so on. It gives you essentially the RAID 10 effect. What that's going to give you is about the highest mean time to data loss, so your fault tolerance is going to be about the best. It's also going to give you the best performance. Okay? The caveat to two-way mirror, obviously, is that RAID 10 effect is essentially the capacity cost. You're going to lose half of your capacity from raw to yield. Okay? But with disks being as cheap as they are, that shouldn't really be too much of a complaint. Then we also have three-way mirror, and this is for the infinitely paranoid. So it's essentially taking a mirrored pair and adding another disk to the mirror. And that gives you, I've done this for you know, the OS volume and stuff like that, for deployments that are going overseas that we may not be able to get attention to right away should they have a problem. So, and we have RAID Z. And RAID Z is very much like RAID 5. It is striping with distributed parity. The only difference between RAID Z and RAID 5 is that ZFS RAID Z does not suffer from the RAID 5 write hole problem, because it uses a variable stripe rate, and its commitments are done in a different way. We got RAID Z2, which is just like RAID 6, essentially, striping with dual distributed parity. And then unlike any of the hardware solutions out there now, we also have RAID Z3, which is triple parity. So if you do run into a situation where, you know, you need that much kind of data protection, and there's another slide I have that will kind of describe how these should be used and when they're best used and stuff like that. And I'll get into that in just a moment. So this is the diagram I was talking about, where we have the disks, and then the disks compiled into a VDEV of RAID Z. So these three disks are one RAID set, those three disks are another RAID set. And each of those compile a VDEV, which are then added into the Z pool. So this is where all your storage is here. And then those Z pools are then carved out into a number of different Z vols and ZFS file systems. So the ZFS file system side, that's where you share out over SIFS or NFS. And then the Z vols, like I said, are raw block devices, and those are shareable by iSCSI and Fibre Channel. And then there's also ways that you can leverage high-speed interconnects for file-level transport, like InfiniBand and stuff like that. InfiniBand is a very interesting protocol, but that some people like, some people don't. You know, it's a matter of latency, really. So it's primarily used in high-performance compute clusters, not really so much for data delivery. So, do I have any questions about the diagram? Yes.
You still get all the underlying benefits of ZFS.
That's right.
Even though you're putting on an AV file system that might not have those
characteristics. Yes, exactly. Okay, so some simple rules for building storage pools. First one is never mix disk sizes or speeds within a VDEV. Okay? You wouldn't want to take a 15K disk and a 7200 RPM disk, make a mirror, and make that a VDEV. You would suffer the lowest common denominator effect when you do that. Okay. The other thing is, like I said before, two-way mirror is preferred. When you deploy in RAID Z, you want to keep the VDEV between 3 and 7 disks. You really don't want to go much more than that. The reason for these limitations and Z2 and Z3 have rules up here as well, is because when you have a disk failure in ZFS, the resolver times can be somewhat lengthy, okay? The ZFS best practices guide that was published by Sun actually says 3 to 9 disks in a VDEV, and that's pretty much all it says. It doesn't really get into changing it around for different RAID levels or anything like that. But the interesting thing about that 9 disk limitation was dreamed up when 250 gig disks were the biggest ones you could get. And I have clients in the field that, against my knowledge or consent, decided that they were going to take all 24 disks in their shelf and make one big RAID Z2. Well, when they had a disk failure, the resolver was 44 days. Okay. Now, that's a pretty long vulnerability window, if you ask me, right? Because you're suspect, right? I mean, you guys all know if you have RAID 5 and a disk fails and you're rebuilding and another one fails, you're probably fired. So when we talk about RAID Z2, we can go a little bit further because we do have that extra parity in there. So you can suffer two failures. Go ahead.
Real quick, why is that so long as compared to traditional RAID?
Typically because it's not only building the data, but it's also rebuilding the metadata that was lost from that disk as well. And a lot of that is constructed by sharing with RAM, going to CPU, sharing with RAM, and then writing to disk and stuff like that. And you can see actually how long the rebuild process is taking by looking at your Zpool status. And you can see the percent busy on the one disk that's getting resolvered on is like 90 and all the rest of them are 2. One other thing real quick is that the rebuild times are also because it also depends on the amount of active IO you have going on the box too. Because a lot of people, like, look, if this is, say you have a deployment that has 100 disks in it, and you have them all in 5 disk VDEVs, okay? That one VDEV that's having a resolver is only 5% of your overall pool. So your whole pool isn't really affected that greatly until it goes to read or write to that particular VDEV. And then you could see a touch of latency and stuff like that, but that's why you want to keep the VDEV small. You know, a, a VDEV should be a very small percentage of your overall deployment. Okay. So, and then RAID Z2, we can go a little bit further out because the vulnerability is not so great, depending on also the size of the disks. And then RAID Z3, we can go quite a bit more. And that RAID Z3 I only use if there's going to be more than 60 disks in the deployment, particularly if they're going to be 3 or 4 terabyte disks, right? And in a deployment like that, if it was RAID Z3, I wouldn't use hot spares. With RAID Z2, RAID Z or Mirror, I usually like to deploy with hot spares.
How many shelves can you hook up to a single server?
2,560. That's
no more?
Well, with I was just about to say, without getting fancy.
And you said you were using, what were you using to connect it?
6 gig SAS. Yeah. Now there are.
I'm not familiar with that, really.
Okay.
Is it like daisy chaining?
Some daisy chaining. It also, you can use multiple controllers, right? And each controller is actually capable of addressing 256 devices. So as you get through all of those devices, obviously, you can get that many. There's also, to get fancy, LSI also has a SAS switch that allows you to create SAS fabrics. It's very much like fiber channel, but it's all SAS. Yeah, so. You could. Yeah, absolutely. Several deployments that we've done in the past where we used RAID cabinets instead of JBODs, and those were all connected by fiber channel into the main filer. That also gives you some distance advantage too, fiber channel does. You know, with SAS, if you're using the SAS switch, there are a couple of active ports on the SAS 6160 that actually triple the distance that you can go with SAS, but that's still not very far. It's like from me to you. Right? So if you're using SAS, you got to keep it kind of within one room. Or if you're using fiber channel, you can go metro. And then you always want to keep your VDEVs congruent. Now, this isn't a hard and fast rule. One of the things that you'll read from blogs on ZFS is that you can do whatever you want. You just take this disk and put it in the pool, and take that disk and put it in the pool, or whatever. They don't have to be the same or anything like that. But you know, that, like I said before, that's going to get you the lowest common denominator effect, right? So if you take a 10 gig drive and a 20 gig drive and you make a mirror, you got a 10 gig mirror. The other 10 gigs are just in the ether. You don't get those, you know? So try to keep them the same as much as you can, particularly in speed and capacity, okay? So going forward, I just want to talk a little bit about what we do. And this is basically it. Pogo's been around since 99. We've got over 5,000 clients worldwide. We do, we ship internationally, we service internationally, we do pretty much all of it. We were the people who pioneered the adoption of Linux and SATA RAID in commodity systems, starting back in 99, and now we're kind of leading the way in software-defined storage deployments. And we do all the cool stuff, you know, support, remote support. We got really good technical engineers at the shop. And stuff like that. You know, we do general purpose servers, we do desktops and workstations, and of course we do our network storage. So I'm going to hand it over to Steve, and he's going to talk for a couple of minutes about basically how Quantastore does everything that I just talked about. Okay, and they do it in a kind of a unique way. We've been partners now for about 2 years, and they just deployed their, or we just actually launched on Friday, the ZFS product. So.
All right. Can you guys hear me okay? All right. So OS Nexus was founded about 4 years ago. My background in storage was with enterprise storage systems and integrating that into products at Veritas Software. We have things like NetBackup, Backup Exec. And then after that, I went to Citrix and worked on Zen Server for a couple of years. And when I was working on Zen Server, the deployments were basically really expensive for these customers because they had to buy a NetApp or an EMC to go deploy with the virtualization platform. And that's where I got the idea of, well, we should build I should go out and start a company that goes and makes a software-defined storage platform so that these companies deploying virtualization have another choice beyond NetApp and EMC that can just use the commodity hardware. And there's Illumos out there and sort of the Nexenta guys had kind of started going down that branch, but I really wanted to do something on Linux, make it so that people could customize it and kind of take a different approach in doing it in a scale-out fashion. And so the genesis of that was to go and take and build a software-defined storage platform that takes all these different technologies that are scale-out and bring them into a flexible platform that does not just the SAN and NAS, but starts to go and pull in these scale-out technologies. So the first one that we've integrated of these kind of blue scale-out technologies is Gluster. We're really far along on Hadoop integration, so you get, when you deploy a QuantaStore appliance, you can do SAN, NAS, Hadoop, and Gluster. And then after that, we're looking at Ceph or OpenStack Swift as sort of the next scale-out technology to pull into the platform. Let's see here. So this is what the UI looks like. It's all web-based. We use the Google Web Toolkit to build the front end. So it's all it looks like a desktop app, but you can use the web browser of your choice or even an iPad to go and manage the storage. And what makes our platform unique from the other software-defined storage companies is the scale-out. So that's why I put in all those servers behind there. You can go and deploy a rack full of these appliances and link them all together. And then you see all the appliances inside the user interface. You can configure network bonding, VLANs, and really use it in a multi-tenant environment. And use the RESTful APIs to do dynamic provisioning for your cloud and fancy things like that. So this is just kind of, you know, the scale out type of things that we're doing. And then of course support for traditional SAN NAS protocols here. We're also digging into Fibre Channel over Ethernet. It's kind of, there's a kind of a niche for that that's growing. There's a lot of work happening at Emulex and QLogic to support Fibre Channel over Ethernet as a target driver on Linux. So it's on our roadmap. The community edition, I just wanted to, this, I think this is my last slide. This is, we've got a, basically we take the whole platform verbatim and limit it to 4 terabytes, but pretty much all the features in the commercial version are all in there. It's all license key controlled, so you can take a community edition and convert it into production just by getting a key. One of the things that also, besides the scale-out aspects of QuantaStore, is we've integrated with hardware RAID management, and that was something that Paul touched on. And one of the big challenges with, you know, using pure software on top of the hardware is replacing drives. You know, you have to integrate with the enclosure and get it so that that light goes red so that you can go and pull the bad one and put a new one in. And our competitors are basically having their customers go in and generate a bunch of I/O and doing some DDs to the pools to try and figure out which light isn't coming on, and then they can figure out which disk to pull out, and then you got to put up a whole bunch of stickers on the front of the drive to figure out what's going wrong. And what we did, we said, look, there's already some really great enterprise RAID controllers out there from LSI, from HP, from the Dell PERC, and we integrated with those. So we have a modular architecture that goes and lets you manage all the hardware RAID right within the platform. And when a drive goes bad, the hardware RAID controller will take a hot spare that you've designated and just automatically fix and auto-heal the thing and replace the bad drive. And it will light up and put a red light on it. So you can have anybody on your staff literally go into the lab or a production environment, just pull the drive that's with the red light on it and put a fresh drive in and you're done. So that's a really big deal. And that just saves a huge amount of time. And so the way that we use ZFS typically is we do a hybrid with ZFS. We use the hardware RAID controller to create a bunch of mirrors or a bunch of RAID 5 or RAID 6 units. And then we use ZFS RAID 0 to stripe across them to go and combine it. And the neat thing there too is that you can combine across RAID controllers. So you can, if you need to build something really big, you can put up to 6 RAID controllers into. That's the biggest deployment we have is about 6 RAID controllers in one chassis or one head unit. And then you can through like as Paul was mentioning, you can go through out to SAS expanders, and typically most of those RAID cards will support about 250 drives. Per RAID controller, so 6 times 250, you can get over 1,000 hard drives, you can get a lot of storage connected up to a single head unit. But in practice, that SAS interconnect to the chassis is going to be limited to about 2.4 gigabytes per second. So you're going to max that out with about 20 drives. So at a certain point, you just want to get a second appliance so that you get the benefits of the increased bandwidth of having multiple appliances. And that's where the grid tech really helps out, because now you're still managing it all as one big box. So yeah, any questions on the Community Edition or anything there? We use the ZFS .61, and they have 6.2 out, and we built that already, and we have a package ready to go deploy with that. But we like to let things sit for a little while. I saw a couple of discussions about somebody that was having a little trouble with the latest build with dedupe turned on, and now all of our deployments we don't turn on dedupe unless it's sort of a special case archive, but. We let things sit for a little while, make sure that everybody's kind of, that we got a nice stable release from them before we roll things out.
Yeah, where does that, they're talking about version 5000 upstairs.
Oh, okay.
Which is apparently the newest open source one. So like how far back is that?
This latest release just came out last month. And the one that we're using is about 4 or 5 months old?
Maybe it's different.
Yeah. I think it is a different version number scheme, yeah. The numbers that the ZFS on Linux team uses, it's just a different structure, yeah. Yeah, question?
So the ZFS on Linux, I thought there was questions about licensing and like that. Someone has figured that out?
Yeah, you can't, if you are, if you have source code that's GPL, and source code that's CDDL, which is the Solaris stuff, you can't intermix those. They're incompatible. But the way that ZFS on Linux gets around that is the entire file system is compiled into dynamically loadable kernel modules. So no different than like a video driver that's a commercial video driver. They've built SPL, it's like a Solaris abstraction layer driver that kind of maps through some of the APIs to the Linux space. But other than that, they've really done a fantastic job just making it a native Linux file system. We build it and then package it in our own Debian package, and that way people don't have to go build the file system. It all comes pre-baked with QuantaStore. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so when we combine hardware RAID, we always use a cache vault. And all of the latest RAID controllers, they used to use battery backup units on there, which were a pain in the ass because they were $250 and then you got to replace them like every 18 months. And what they would do is when they go bad, they go to basically write through. You no longer get your write cache. And the battery backup unit, because it is able to cache a gigabyte of writes, it eliminates the write hole, because if there is a transaction that was still in flight, it's going to be held in memory in that non-volatile RAM, even if you reboot the box. But the other challenge with the batteries was that they'd only keep the charge for like 48 hours. So now what they've got with the cache vault stuff is there's a supercapacitor, so when the power gets cut, it goes and writes it to a flash drive. So it doesn't really matter. You can have the box turned off indefinitely, turn it back on, and then it'll commit the rest of the writes out to disk. So all the deployments where we use hardware RAID all use the cache vault technology. And companies like Dell, who make like the PERC controllers, which is a rebranded LSI, their latest controllers all have the cache vault built right into it. So whereas LSI has it like as an add-on option, Dell is just saying, no, we're just not shipping this stuff without the cache vault. So that's really nice to see. We integrated module, we built modules for LSI Mega RAID, which is also Dell PERC and the IBM Serve RAID. And then we wrote other modules for Adaptec and HP Smart Array. Did some integration with Fusion IO. So we've got a pretty broad set of hardware RAID controllers that are all supported. And then most recently, we added an enclosure view. So not only do you see like the red light when the disk goes bad, you see inside the user interface a diagram of your enclosure chassis. And when the drive goes bad, it turns red. So that you know visually which drive to go pull. And then you go into the data center and you can see the red light on it and everything matches up. You just pull it. So we're using Ubuntu server. LTS 1204, we're going to move up to 1404 when that comes out next year. And we've got a lot of customers that add custom packages. So one of the neat things about software-defined storage is that you can put Splunk onto your storage appliance. So you can monitor the various diagnostics and things like that that you do with your servers with your in the same way with your storage. So that's nice. And we've even got a customer that's doing like some interesting things with like OCFS2, the cluster file system. They use that with their iSCSI storage that comes out of the QuantaStore appliance, but then they remounted OCFS2 within the box itself because they wanted to re-expose the cluster file system over NFS. So all kinds of tricky, cool stuff you can do with software-defined storage like our QuantaStore appliance platform that would just be just not an option when you go to proprietary platforms like Equalogic or a NetApp or something. Yeah.
Are there any features missing with Linux versions
of NFS? Yeah, you know, there were some things that I'm trying to remember. It was like you can do some weird mixing now with the latest ZFS on Solaris, where you could like take a VDEV that was like a mirror and then go and add one that was like a RAID Z2 or something like that and do some really funky things. But I went through the feature list and there wasn't anything that really stood out that was like a major, oh, I gotta have that between what's the ZFS on Linux versus the ZFS on Solaris. So it's pretty current.
With ZFS snapshot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we use BCBs, right?
Yeah.
So basically what we do is we pause our database, we snap off a copy, and then we unpause the database, and then run that one to tape.
Yeah. Right? And then you have no spindle contention because the BCV is off on its own.
Yeah, and it goes to a box and whatever. So can you do that sort of thing with ZFS?
You sure can. It doesn't do it in the same way that you would with a BCV in a symmetrics, whereas with the symmetrics the way that snapshots were done with these enterprise systems was you'd have like a three-way mirror, and then you'd break off a mirror, and then you could go and run database and all kinds of stuff against that and not interrupt any I/O on the primary. With ZFS, the snapshotting is using the copy-on-write technology, so all the data is in the same Z pool. But what's really neat is you can create many, many snapshots, and they're all read-write. ZFS snapshots are read-only. You kind of do this, you stack a clone on top, it's space efficient. And when you do a snapshot within QuantaStore, we do a snap clone. We do a snapshot, then a clone on top, so the device is read-write. And in the product, you can just bring up this little dialog and say, I want to create a snapshot schedule. And you just click on all the NAS and storage volumes that you want to have snapshot. And you give it a schedule, you just say, I want it on these times a day, on these days of the week, and give it a name, you know, like backup schedule, and click OK, and it does it for you.
Are the snapshots, like you could, have your production disks?
Yeah.
Right, and then have your snapshot mounted to a different, like, to a backup server?
Totally. And you can even use it for VDI. So you can make a template, and then snapshot it 100 times, and pass it out as virtual desktops. And then with a cool thing there too is that the snapshots are space efficient. So let's say you create a template that's 50 gigabytes and you snapshot it 100 times, you're still only using 50 gigabytes. So it really saves a lot of space, and that's really important for those VDI deployments that are sitting on that high cost SSD storage. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, say again?
What is the stability of this thing?
Oh, of QantaStore? Or we use Linux, so we're using the 3.8 kernel. So right now we don't have a dual head node HA that's coming out actually at the end of this month, so that you can go and take two server head units and do attach it to a JBOD unit over mini SAS. And then if one head goes down, the other one will automatically take over the pool on the other. And we're actually working with LSI on some really cool tech in that area too. The LSI has got, you know, their mega RAID controllers. And one of the problems with using a RAID controller is if they've got some data in that cache that needs to be committed and you fail over to another head node, well, you gotta be able to get that data out of that cache and pull it over, but you can't because the box is gone. So what they did is they developed this technology called Synchro, which keeps the write-back cache and the two RAID controllers in sync. And it communicates over the SAS bus. And so we're really excited about that. So the first rev is gonna be just a standard HBA-based HA failover. So in that case, you'd use like ZFS RAID 10, and you wouldn't really be using any of the fancy mega RAID hardware RAID stuff. But when we get the Synchro tech integrated, then you'll get the best of both worlds. You get the hardware RAID and the ability to have the enclosure services combined with the HA technology. Yeah. Yeah.
So why on Linux? Is more better availability of device drivers?
Or? Yeah, big time.
I mean,
yeah.
Luminos or BSD.
Yeah. I'm kind of a Linux head, so I didn't want to follow behind the Nexenta guys, and because they kind of really were driving the Lumos platform, and I just kind of felt like that the IT, you know, if you take a look at how many people understand Solaris versus understand Linux, I felt like we really needed to build the platform on Linux, and we kind of suffered for a while because we didn't have enough features in the key features in the product, because everything that we built initially was off of ButterFS, which we couldn't roll into production, and XFS. So this was a real boon to our platform. In Q1, we started doing the integration with ZFS, and then we had deployments that were Paul was selling it before it was done. Literally, we rolled it out with a couple of customers like. 2 weeks, he had some sales, we had it done, and it went out the door. And those have just been tremendously successful, where they, it was the first deployment was 100 terabytes, and it turned into 400 within a couple of weeks. And now they're knocking on the door for more. So it's been really great. We kind of pinned our hopes on ButterFS. We really wanted to do something that was pure Linux, that project has really gone a lot slower than we were hoping it would. So, yeah. Yeah.
So what types of performance testing tools do you guys use to get benchmarks? Do you use the same tools against vendors?
One-to-one Iometer, is the number one. And usually we'll throw a Windows 2008 server. And then there's some tools we use on VMware. Those are the two main things that we test for, because there's such a huge community around VMware. And then Windows as a client gives you a really good, their IO stack is great as a client IO stack. And so it's just combining it with like multipath IO and fiber channel, we can really tax the QantaStore deployments and really find out what they can do. So, using like dual ported 8 gig fiber channel against a QantaStore box, you throw like 16 drives in there, you'll see over 1 gigabyte per second sustained throughput. When you create a pool of storage within QantaStore, you actually have two choices. You got ZFS and XFS. And ZFS is the default now because it's got all the snapshotting features and things like that. But we left XFS in there because some of the post-production deployments we have, like Zoic Studios, those guys did Battlestar Galactica and Firefly and some of those series. Their need is just massive sequential. Type of workloads for rendering video frames and things like that. And so XFS was a better fit for them. And XFS has so little overhead, we can max out the RAID controller. So we'll get like 1.6 gigabytes per second per RAID card, and they're one of our larger deployments with like 6 RAID cards into one box, and they can max out all of them. That was something that surprised us too. We thought the PCI bus wouldn't keep up, but we were able to run iometer tests and just pin all of those RAID controllers, and the PCI bus was delivering 1.5 to 1.6 gigabytes per second per card. So it was pretty terrific, performance-wise and everything. Yeah.
So by going to the back to the RAID hardware.
Yeah.
I understand getting the management and connectivity, just the number of devices.
Yeah.
But is the RAID capability itself actually useful? I mean, one of the premises for ZFS was that general purpose CPUs were fast enough that you didn't need dedicated RAID.
Yeah, and that's true. You know, my background working on the volume manager and file system at Veritas, I mean, we were always like, hey, you can do all this stuff in software. But it turned out that those deployments, oftentimes, they were using Veritas, the software stack, just as a way to migrate their storage between storage systems. And this is kind of a similar thing where it's like, ZFS has the ability to do RAID tech in there, and they've got a great, you know, commit engine for it, so that you don't have that RAID 5 write hole, as Paul was mentioning. But just trying to manage drive replacement and hot spares and all those kinds of things, it's just done way better with the hardware RAID. And there's, you know, they sell a couple hundred thousand of those hardware RAID controllers a year, and so there's a huge, huge amount of users using it,
so
and we get to cap. You can use JBOD. Quantistor doesn't dictate one or the other. So if you have a RAID card, there's a little section in the UI here. Let me go back. I'll jump down here. This right here, it's an eye chart. You can't read it, but it says hardware enclosures and controllers. So if you have a hardware RAID card, you just click here and you'd see it appear there, and you can go in there and create RAID units. And then those show up as physical drives, because the RAID card's gonna go aggregate and make a big 20 terabyte disk. That just shows up as a single physical disk. And then you just go to this section here and say create a pool, and you check the one disk. Yeah, but you don't need, yeah.
Why use the RAID capabilities on the card?
Because the if you don't use the RAID capabilities on the card, then it can't integrate with the enclosure to mark
okay,
which disk is bad. Yeah.
You can't just manage it.
Yeah, and there's the hot spare management with the RAID card is much better than the hot spare management with ZFS. So the last bit of that too is that you're completely insulating the operating system from drive failures. When you have a drive failure, there's challenges with some of these device drivers where they can kind of hang, you know, trying to like commit a write or something, and then it's got to realize, oh, okay. This drive is gone, and there's this kind of limbo state that can happen with pure software solutions. The hardware RAID controller doesn't have that problem. You know, that disk is failing. They've got all this technology in their custom ASICs that just says that sucker's bad. I'm going to go and start rebuilding it and eject it. And so it gathers data from smart, but then they have their own technologies to figure out when a drive goes bad. And so the overall maintenance of it. It's so much simpler. So that was our largest partner is IBM. So in the SoftLayer cloud, they deploy Quantistor boxes for customers, and that was one of the big reasons why they picked us. Is that they're an all Adaptec shop, and they needed to be able to just replace bad drives in the servers with ease, and so that tie-in to the hardware RAID just made life easy for them. So. Yeah, what they'll do is they'll take and make a RAID 10 unit with a RAID controller, and then when they create a pool within Quantistor, it's a pool of one logical device. So it's really simple. It just stacks right on top. Yeah. Yeah.
For the community edition, was that 4 terabytes for like raw storage?
It is raw. We're going to bump it up to like 6 or 8. So if you get a key that's 4, just send me an email or send an email to support, and we'll get you a bigger key. But we're going to tweak the license server to just bump that up to get a little bigger. Yeah. The The software is done per terabyte, and we have like a silver edition that's like weekday support, and then a gold edition that's 24/7 with maximum 8-hour response. But we're usually back to folks within an hour. So yeah, cool. Any other questions? Well, thanks so much for coming out, and Paul and I will be around and everything. If you have any other questions later on, and thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.